Today we're going to discuss secessions and referendums. We are, of course, talking about the so-called Brexit. With us, we have Keir Martland from the British Libertarian Alliance. Hello, Keir, and welcome to the Swedish Radio Mises podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also, of course, we have Klaus and me, Hans.
Hello, hello.
Maybe before we start, we would just like to extend our best wishes for Sean Gabb, who is the current director of Libertarian Alliance, and we've come to understand that he's been very ill recently. We all hope he's doing better soon.
Yeah, see, he is on the mend. I've just been alerted. He is slowly getting healthier and fitter, but it may be a long process.
What happened to him?
Blood poisoning. It was very serious, but I don't want to jinx it. But it looks like he's over the worst of it.
Did he eat something bad or get a cut or something?
Klaus, that's food poisoning.
Yeah, you're right.
This is what's known as septicemia. So somehow some bugs got into his bloodstream and almost killed him.
That sounds really awful.
It is really awful, yeah.
So Keir, can you sort of introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the Libertarian Alliance?
Yeah, sure. I'm Keir Martland. I'm the youth director of the Libertarian Alliance. I have been since August 2014. The Libertarian Alliance has been around since the 1970s, and we regard ourselves as the most extreme, the most radical free market and civil liberties organisation in the United Kingdom. We are registered as an educational charity by the British government, and so we are therefore, I suppose, almost respectable. We have links internationally, of course, with the Property and Freedom Society, with all manner of organizations. We're basically the most overt libertarians in the United Kingdom. And we have a podcast, we have a blog, and all kinds of online things like that.
So we have a proper extremist here with us today.
A real extremist, yes.
Yes. You're very big on free speech, if I understood things correctly.
Yeah. Freedom of speech is something which has always been something regarded as fairly uncontroversial in the English mindset. It's, you know, whether or not you're a classical liberal or not, or whether you're a more extreme libertarian or an anarchist or whatever, it's something which the English people in particular have always believed in. And yet at the moment, it does seem to be under threat. There are always different pretexts for government laws to tamper with it. But at the moment, of course, it's the supposed Islamist threat, the supposed terrorist threat. And so we have a supposedly conservative government, which is issuing things called extremist disruption orders. And so this means, literally, if you don't believe in the ideal of democracy, you can be officially silenced. That's quite scary. And so freedom of speech is more important than ever.
I mean, we have, I guess, the same sort of trends here in Sweden, but nothing that serious, I would say. I mean, there are actually quite a few defenders of freedom of speech in Sweden. Obviously, they get called names and so on, but I mean, it seems to be a general trend that free speech only as long as people say nice things is the way people want it these days.
Exactly. And of course, Ron Paul's, one of my favorite lines from Ron Paul is, we don't have freedom of speech so we can talk about the weather.
Yeah.
We have freedom of speech so we can talk about all kinds of controversial things. And yet it's also happening in universities, but I don't think we should trivialize it and say that it's only something that's happening in the universities. Yes, we're seeing more and more safe spaces and things like that. So much so that when Sean was recently speaking at one of the libertarian societies at a university in Britain, he had to be very, very guarded and very, very moderate in things that he said, for the sake of himself and for the sake of the students who had decided to come and listen to him. And there was actually an official member of staff from the university. And this is the London School of Economics, by the way, a very illustrious university. But they actually put a member of staff to watch and make sure that nothing controversial was said at a meeting of the Hayek Society, for goodness sake, at the London School of Economics.
Yeah,
that's almost disturbing in how afraid people are of someone saying something that might offend someone.
What are they looking for? What is the censor looking for?
I don't know. Of course, the pretext, as I've said, at the moment is Islamist terrorism. Is Sean going to turn up and trivialize the threat from ISIS? Is he going to say that we're not all going to die from ISIS? Because that is the main, one of the main themes of this government at the moment. We are under threat. We must therefore give up all of our historic civil liberties in order to be safe from ISIS. And if anyone denies this, if anyone denies the very need to go in and send troops and drones and airstrikes to Syria and Iraq, if anyone denies that, they are a terrorist sympathizer. David Cameron actually said that in the House of Commons.
So ISIS deniers, they're a threat too.
So at the moment,
regarding Iraq, isn't Tony Blair famous for saying that Iraq could invade Britain, or at least attack Britain from over there?
Yeah, of course. I think what we're thinking about at the moment is the dodgy dossier, the famous dodgy dossier, which was a government document which was completely falsified and full of lies, on the back of which we went into Iraq for the blatant purpose of regime change. But one of the major lies that Tony Blair told was that Saddam Hussein was in possession of weapons of mass destruction which could reach the United Kingdom within 45 minutes and kill us all, when of course what he probably meant was it could get to certain states in the Middle East in 45 minutes.
Yeah, almost the same thing, right?
Yeah.
So what can the free speech censors, the government, do if you said there was some official thing they could do to silence you? How would that work?
I don't know the mechanics of it. That's what's so scary. All of the laws that are being drafted at the moment are drafted in such that they're drafted in order to be vague, so that the government can make up conventions on the spot. The main law that's going through Parliament at the moment, which will really solidify the high-tech police state, is the Investigatory Powers Bill. And this will give the police, the security services, even local council officials, the right to look at the last, I think, 2 years or maybe the last year of all of your metadata, and so all of the communications data that you use on that comes from stuff that you've done online, and also your mobile phone and landline information, they will know when we're communicating, they'll know from where we're communicating, on any pretext they like.
I mean, the British surveillance state is pretty impressive.
Very impressive, yeah.
You've probably seen the movie V for Vendetta.
What
is it about Britain and the surveillance? Why is it so much more advanced than other places?
I don't know. That's a very good question. But it certainly is. I think we have... I think the detention without trial limit in Russia is 4 days. So the length of time that you can go in Russia having been detained without being charged of a crime is 4 days. In Britain, I think it's now 14 days. That puts things into perspective. Tony Blair wanted it to be 90 days.
You can disappear for 90 days.
Yeah, you can be held in a police.
People.
Yeah, yeah, disappearing people on the grounds usually of alleged of being an alleged threat to national security for 90 days. For a very long time after that, it was raised to 28 days. That 28-day limit expired, I think, a couple of years ago, and so now it's 14.
But I think Sweden has 2 or 3 days.
Yeah. And so the country in which the very ideas of freedom of speech, freedom of association, due process of the law, the rule of law, these things don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
They just don't exist.
Interesting.
Since we're going to talk a bit about the EU, I just would like to mention, Klaus, maybe you can help me here. In Sweden, we had the, you know, sort of the same storing of metadata. We had one brave internet provider that refused to do it. But didn't the EU sort of strike down on this recently and said you can't store it for, or was it just the amount of time you could store it? I'm not sure.
I think it was actually about storing it at all.
I'm referring to what in Sweden is called the datalagringsdirektiv for our Swedish listeners. Which was, struck down by the...
Yeah, because Bahnhof, as they're called, the provider, they immediately turned it off. Because Sweden is funny in that way. When something comes from the EU, Sweden is always the first and most enthusiastic implementer of that new law. I don't know what it's about, but it's some really childish form of obedience. And they usually like to go even further.
Exactly.
So this was an EU idea from the beginning, and instead of protesting it, they gladly forced all internet providers to implement this. And one of them kind of fought it, but I think was forced in the end. And then the EU came and said, no, we can't really do this. This is not allowed.
They're never really enthusiastic about rolling back things in this country. We're just enthusiastic about when we get a decree, we'll perform it. But when it's rolled back, they're really slow in rolling it back.
So I don't know what happened. Did they stop it now, or are they still? I think. Did they stop it?
I mean, we have the same thing as in Britain. I mean, the government wants all these things in place just in case they need them. So I'm fairly certain that they. I mean, officially, they might have stopped doing it, or they're labeling it something else, but probably in the background, they're still collecting the data under some pretext anyway.
Just to elaborate on this in a more general sense, this is how the European Union works. The European Union, properly speaking, has very little power of its own at the moment anyway. The European Union works by getting the willing agreement of various national ruling classes. For instance, the European arrest warrant. I believe Austria doesn't even enforce this because they choose not to. Look at Hungary and Poland. Hungary and Poland are becoming much more right-wing. Hungary in particular has said they're not going to take any refugees. The European Union has done nothing that I know of to stop them. So it tends to be just particular states within the European Union which are more enthusiastic and particular states which are less enthusiastic. It may be, therefore, an oversimplification to say that the European Union is a federal superstate which is destroying the national sovereignty of its members. I don't know. It's a risk, to stay in the European Union and expect things to carry on as they are, and therefore I would say we have to leave. But at the moment, and the way things have been working out, the way the European Union has functioned is not as an organisation which has completely destroyed the national sovereignty of the various nations, but actually as a fig leaf for the various ruling classes. The way it works in Britain, I assume this is the same in Sweden, is a politician who has a particularly authoritarian or socialist idea and senses that this isn't something which will be popular in his country, will go to Brussels or go to Strasbourg and organize behind closed doors something which will have his desired end, and then come back to his home country and say, oh, there's nothing we can do about it, it's all Europe.
Yeah, so you're saying that Brussels is sort of a vehicle for certain political
exactly.
groups in the
exactly.
separate
yeah.
nations. Yeah, you sort of get that. I mean, you often get that impression that some pressure group, national pressure group, has just taken a sort of detour through the European Union and come back with something they wanted from the beginning.
Yeah. But of course, some states go further, don't they? As you were saying,
yeah.
Sweden goes further. A lot
always
of the tyranny,
best in class.
Yeah, a lot of the tyranny doesn't come from Europe. For instance, the Psychoactive Substances Bill, which is going through Parliament at the moment, I think it's actually passed, actually, which has banned all previous legal highs. So if you wanted to enjoy yourself in private and take something which was sort of a mind-altering, well, definitely a mind-altering drug, but not an illegal drug, if you wanted to do that, you could do that. Now you can't. And it was a terribly drafted law. At one point, Earl Grey tea was going to be illegal. At one point, a drug that gay people use in order to have better sex was going to be illegal. But the gay lobby picked up on this, and so it was dropped quietly. But again, that didn't come from Brussels. And so some states go further, some states just reject EU law entirely.
You would think that trying to ban tea would cause sort of an outrage in Britain.
Well, it's Earl Grey tea, it's not very nice.
All right, fair enough.
Hey, Keir, just a question. You're quite young yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask how old you are?
Yes, I'm 17.
Yeah. And how long have you been in the freedom movement or freedom mindset? And
Mindset.
What was your path?
Freedom mindset longer than the freedom movement. Freedom mindset probably about four years, I think. But I've been with the Libertarian Alliance since late 2014. I was in the Conservative Party for far too long, and I only quite lately, sort of early on in 2013, realized what the Conservative Party was, and realized that there weren't any political routes that I could see towards furthering these ideas. And so I found the LA, and the LA is everything it's cracked up to be.
So you've always had these ideas, but you didn't find the right group, so to speak, or
I think I do buy into the idea that libertarians are generally speaking born that way. They have this predisposition. They just don't like being told what to do in general, and they want smaller government or no government at all. That's not something which is easy to teach someone. And so for me, it was just a matter of stumbling upon the right literature and not being won over by it, but just agreeing with it all. You know, when I was reading Rothbard and then reading Hopper, I was just going through every page and going, yeah, this is common sense. Why don't people believe this? And, you know, that this is very much Sean Gabb's viewpoint. He was always a libertarian, but it took reading John Stuart Mill and George Orwell and I think The Scarlet Pimpernel as well to just, you know, come to the conclusion that he was a libertarian. But literature doesn't generally win people over. It makes people realize that they're a libertarian.
Well, same thing with logical arguments. They don't win people over either. I don't know what does win people over, but emotions, maybe.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Art wins people over.
Yeah.
All right. I think we're going to try to get into this whole Brexit thing.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I mean, Brexit, it basically means that Britain votes to if you're going to stay in the European Union or not. But suppose you vote, or the British people vote, to not stay in the European Union. What happens then? I mean, is everything is. I can't believe that all contact with other European countries will that day, you know, just suddenly stop. Has anybody thought about what to do afterwards?
I actually think this is the most likely scenario. Because of the way the British electorate tends to work, you know, with differential turnout, I think this is quite likely to be the outcome of the referendum vote, at least. Old people tend to vote in larger numbers than young people. More Eurosceptic people will probably turn out to vote than people who want to stay in the European Union. This is all sort of common sense stuff. I think that's how the referendum will go. I think we'll probably have a pretty convincing outvote. But what follows from that is very difficult to predict. And it's very difficult to predict because the most frustrating thing about this referendum is that it's not a referendum on the continued or otherwise membership of the European Union. It's really, so far as I can see, and lots of other observers, just a civil war within the Conservative Party and within the government. So if you vote to stay in the European Union, that's a vote of confidence in the government as it is. If you vote to leave, then that's a vote for a change of prime minister. You know, perhaps this is an incredibly cynical way to look at it, but it seems to me that this is how it's going to work. And so the potential successors for David Cameron, the Eurosceptic ones at least, appear to be Boris Johnson or Michael Gove.
Mm.
And the trouble with these people is they're even more neoconservative than David Cameron.
It's that bad.
It's that bad. We don't have very much choice. I mean, if we vote to stay in, David Cameron may have to go anyway. His reputation during this campaign has been completely tarnished.
Right.
He may have to step down. He's just been going around from television studio to television studio and in front of audiences, which just boo him whenever he says anything. And for instance, the night before last, or it might have been last night, on a television program, a young lady said the F word at him twice in quick succession. And the television presenter said nothing. No, the television presenter didn't stop this girl swearing and shouting at him. And the audience just didn't react either. Now, when you've got a prime minister that's that hated, it seems like he's going to go quite soon. And the EU referendum will probably be a good excuse for him to go. So
why is he so hated?
I don't know. It's just...
It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the EU referendum. It's something else.
He seems to have a reputation as a liar. That's pretty accurate. Most of the things he says aren't true. He changes his position from one day to the next. He's a very untrustworthy politician, and people just generally don't trust him. It may also be that he seems to be a member of the old guard. He seems to be, you know, an Etonian. He went to, you know, public school. He went to Eton. He went to then Oxford. I don't know. Maybe that's it. Maybe this reaction against him is a sort of socialist egalitarian one. Mm. I don't know. But the possible successors aren't any better. And so I wouldn't get your hopes up that we actually would leave the European Union in any meaningful sense.
No, assume most likely perhaps is Boris Johnson.
Yes.
And I mean, Boris seems like a funny feller, but I'm sure he's, like you say, probably not better than Cameron, perhaps worse. But assuming he becomes prime minister and has successfully won the EU referendum, he has to at least do something, you know, yeah. I suppose. He has to at least do some gestures of sort of cutting the ties with the European Union, doesn't he?
Well, you'd hope so. You would hope so. But he has made his entire political career out of being pro-Europe and pro-immigration. Now, that's always been the case throughout his political career. And this only changed at the very beginning of this European Union referendum campaign I don't trust a word he says.
So he's not one of the Eurosceptics that have always resided in the Tory party.
No, he's not a historic Eurosceptic. But yet suddenly, when it looks like there's a chance of unseating David Cameron, he has become a Eurosceptic. Mm. He started using these sound bites. He started using phrases like "we must take control," "we must control our borders," "we must become more democratic." And yet, throughout his political career, he's been an advocate for European expansion, for Turkey in particular, joining the European Union. And quite recently, he was in favour of a complete and total amnesty for all illegal immigrants, and there are lots of them, who have come to Britain. And yet, suddenly, he's in favour of lower immigration. I don't believe that.
I mean, that's fairly... Yeah. I mean, didn't he just hurl this Turkey in the European Union thing at David Cameron a few days ago?
Yeah. But yeah, he may have to deliver in order to win over public opinion if he does become prime minister. Yes. Even so, I just can't see how he would take Britain out of the European Union, having been such an ardent supporter of it for about 20 years. So... if the European Union referendum has low turnout, if, say, 50% or 60% of the population turn out to vote, and if the majority in favour of leaving isn't very high, perhaps what he will say is, OK, well, obviously the public have registered a protest, and obviously they want things to change, but they haven't registered a clear enough message, and therefore what I'm going to do is I'm going to have another renegotiation of the terms of membership of the European Union, like David Cameron did just a few months ago, and I'm going to see if I can get a better deal. And the phrase "better deal" was the phrase that Johnson used the moment he became this sudden Eurosceptic overnight. And so I think the outcome will be another renegotiation, which may perhaps involve... associate membership, perhaps, fewer regulations, fewer directives, no more rulings from the Commission. I don't know, but things will change, but not massively.
But for us not living in the UK, it would still be a signal to the EU. Yeah, depending on, as you say, depending on what actually happens, if you withdraw or not. But
I think Euroscepticism is a trend that I think will continue. We have sort of a beginning movement back to sort of nationalism from internationalism in Europe, and I think this is just barely begun. Where it ends up is impossible to say.
Well, definitely. This what I'm saying about the Conservative Party and the dividing line between the supposed Eurosceptics and the supposed Europhiles within the Conservative Party. This is what's happening at the top, and this is what will actually happen in terms of government. But that's not to say that I do entirely agree with you that there is, under the surface, a massive growth in Euroscepticism, and within Britain there is a genuine Eurosceptic movement. And the genuine Eurosceptic movement is behind UKIP, it's behind Nigel Farage, it's behind another organisation called Grassroots Out and another organisation called Leave.eu. And that all of these organisations, which had big conferences, they have lots and lots of supporters, lots of ordinary people who are generally opposed to the European Union definitely want us to leave. And Nigel Farage is, the word that you said, he's a nationalist as opposed to an internationalist. And so there is, under the surface, a growing Euroscepticism, a move away from, a desire for a move away from globalism in favour of the nation state. But I'm very pessimistic in terms of whether this will have, in the short or immediate term, any influence on the British government.
So this Euroscepticism may be moderated somewhat by the ruling elites.
Definitely. And don't expect any change at all in terms of immigration.
Right.
There may be some change, perhaps, in Britain's relationship with the European Commission and the European Council and all of the various bureaucratic and supranational bodies. Yeah, things may change. They may rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic.
But
no cuts to immigration.
How is immigration in the UK? In Sweden, it's been out of control, but the kind of, you know this better than I do, Hans, but the
basically
close the borders, kind of, in a way.
We have border controls now, which means that we're down to, you know, maybe less than 20% of what we had last year. In last year, we had refugees and migrants totaling about a percentage of our population in 1 year, 1.5%. But you know, somehow our wise overlords realized that this development was not gonna, you know, work. So now we have border controls, and they actually let through migrants and refugees as long as they have passports. But, you know, most of them don't, so they get stuck in Denmark or Germany. And now they know that there is a border control, so they don't even go to Denmark or Germany.
How is it working in the UK with immigration? Who's the driving force behind this? Who wants it, and why? And what's the situation like?
I don't know who's the particular driving force of it at the moment, but certainly big business benefits and the state benefits. The two definitely benefit from large numbers of generally unskilled economic migrants. The figures at the moment, the official figures at least, are that immigration is running annually at 330,000 a year, which is the equivalent of the population of my hometown of Wigan every single year. And yet the unofficial figures that I've seen are immigration of about 500,000 a year. The population even of the United Kingdom is a point of debate. The official figures say that it's perhaps as high as 65 million. But actually, a few years ago, there was a case brought against Tesco, the supermarket, by the Monopolies Commission. And they were saying that Tesco had too high a share in the market and that Tesco must therefore sell off some of its stores and so forth. But Tesco replied, no. You are using incorrect population figures. You are using the figures from the census. What we are doing is using our own population figures, because after all, we know how many people we need to sell to. And we estimate that the population of Britain is upwards of 70 odd million. And so,
So basically, your largest grocery chain probably does a better census than the government.
Exactly. I trust Tesco rather than the state to work out how big the population is. And that was a few years ago. So, you know, who's to know what the population is? It could be 80 million. Who knows? But definitely, Britain is now one of the most overcrowded, one of the most densely populated countries in Europe. Now, as for who's driving it, you only need to look at the motives behind the new Labour government, which came to power in 1997. And this was disclosed, I don't know whether it was in memoirs or an off-the-cuff statement, I can't remember, but Andrew Neither, who is a former speechwriter to the Labour Prime Minister Tony Blair from, the Prime Minister from 1997 to 2007, said that the Labour government literally sent out search parties to get immigrants to come to Britain. And they did this in order to, quote, rub the noses of the right in diversity.
I've heard that statement. I mean, you almost can't believe someone in a political position would actually say you're right, something like that.
Mm. Oh, and so those are the motives.
It's similar to Reinfeldt and his deal with Miljöpartiet. Yeah, so it's not, I mean, it's not that far off. But it's...
No, in Sweden we have one party that you can't speak of or associate with, and of course all the other parties make a sport out of distancing themselves and saying that, well, this party is against immigration, so too bad for them, we're having lots of immigration. And, you know, sort of childish instincts among politicians. But, I mean, in Sweden, generally, it's almost always humanitarian grounds that are put forth. We shall do this on humanitarian grounds. We don't look at the consequences because our humanitarianism demands that we do not, you know, close our borders. And then we had to sort of close our
borders. That's actually the second stage. The first one was, we do this to save our welfare state. We need bodies. Exactly. We need bodies.
That's a similar argument to the one that we're hearing at the moment. We need foreign doctors and nurses. We need foreign teachers. We need foreign construction workers. So basically, we need these people to do work for us, and we need them to keep us alive through being doctors and nurses, when most of them probably don't have a PhD
If the argument was at least economically sound, we could debate whether this was a path you would like to go as a nation. But yeah, I mean, the argument is economically completely unsound, and you know, all serious studies shows it. I mean, if you take in refugees, you can do it on humanitarian grounds, fine, but you can't sort of make economics out of refugees, and all studies show this. Yeah. So this argument it's sort of disturbing every time they bring it up, because it's a lie.
Yeah. And so, you know, just to sort of summarize when it comes to immigration and the European Union, one of the major problems with the European Union is that Britain has an open door to 508 million people. So in theory, 508 million people, if they really wanted to, I don't know why they would at the moment, but if they really wanted to, they could all turn up in London tomorrow. And because they all have European Union passports, they would get a certain measure of British welfare. They could eventually get British citizenship if they wanted to. So we do have 508 million people who have completely open rights to come to Britain. And when it comes to libertarianism and this, so many libertarians are completely starry-eyed. I'm sure you've come across these libertarians who will not talk about immigration, or who think that it's racist to do so, or think that it is a requirement of libertarian theory to have completely open borders. Now, again, Milton Friedman had one line on immigration, which was that if you have no welfare state, fewer immigrants will come. And that will be a step in the right direction, perhaps. But I'm more swayed by the argument from Hans Hermann Hopper, which is that immigration, as it unfolds at the moment, is not a proprietarian system. Immigration is something which effectively rides roughshod over the property rights of millions of domestic taxpayers. Because these are the people who support infrastructure, these are the people who support public property. And so if you have an open door, then you are letting unlimited numbers of people to use public property, which is not owned by them and which they have not built. And so it's really a question of property rights. And the kind of immigration system that I would like to see is one which is much more like the system which is advocated by Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage advocates the system that they have in Australia, where they let in immigrants on a point-by-point basis. Of course, that's not perfect. Even then, you'll get some measure of forced exclusion and some measure of forced integration. But it would be an improvement. Of course, the ultimate libertarian solution would be, of course, no public property at all and no state. But the ultimate, solution that you could have with a state would be to have immigration completely decentralized, and immigration on the basis of whether or not that immigrant has been invited.
Yeah.
And if we had that, then I can't somehow imagine So, upwards of 330,000 people coming every year.
And your 500 odd million, is that not even, that's not even including Turkey, which are now getting visa-free entrance to Europe.
That would be another 80 million, I think,
Yeah, I don't think Turkey will get visa-free entry, actually, but that's,
I'm not sure if they really want to or not. It's
I think that was just positioning from the EU. I think they're actually going to deny it in the end, but that's just a private theory I have going.
We'll see.
Yeah. Maybe we can, you know, just briefly mention, you had a referendum, was it 2 years ago, the Scottish referendum about Scotland breaking free from the rest of Britain?
Yes, it was 2 years ago.
Any reflections on that, what it was about and, you know, how it turned out?
It was a very, very well-participated referendum. So as far as referendums go, I suppose it had a... The outcome had a decent claim to be quite democratic, I suppose. I think 85% of Scottish people actually turned out to vote, which is very good. And of course, the result was to stay with the union. They did this, of course, because they know how their bread is buttered. They know that they get a lot of money from English taxpayers. What's the equivalent example I could use? I believe parts of is it the north of Italy that wants to secede from the south?
Yeah,
I think their argument is they want to secede because the south is lazy and the south doesn't do very much work and the south is unproductive. Well, it's the other way around, actually, with Scotland and the rest of the union, because Scotland is a very unproductive part of the United Kingdom. Scotland gets much more in terms of welfare than they actually pay in. And so they decided, well, if we leave, we won't get all this free stuff. If we leave, we won't get free university education. If we leave, we won't get all these welfare benefits. Whereas, of course, in the rest of the United Kingdom, you have to pay to go to university. It's still subsidized, but you have to pay. Now, as for why it was held, I'm not entirely sure. It was demanded, actually, by the Scottish Parliament. They said, we need a referendum. We demand a referendum. And David Cameron actually caved in. David Cameron said, okay. I don't know why he did that. Perhaps he felt that it would have been politically impossible for him not to have a referendum on the issue. But it's been completely counterproductive, because even though the independence side of the referendum lost in 2014, there are continual demands for another referendum. Mm. And if we leave the European Union, then Scotland, being, of course, overwhelmingly pro-EU because they get money from the EU, because Scotland is largely quite left-wing, they will want another referendum on whether they remain part of the United Kingdom. They will then vote to leave, and then, you know, they want to then become a satellite of the European Union. As for the result, I'm not sure I agree with Ron Paul when he said that the referendum was probably rigged. It's very difficult in reality to rig a referendum or election. So I think the result was probably quite accurate, and people just did vote because they wanted all the free stuff that they get from being part of the United Kingdom, you know, sponging off English taxpayers. Mm-hmm. But I think we'll probably end up at some point having another referendum.
Yeah, they say the demographics were the other way around in that referendum. Old people voted to stay in and young people voted to get out. Is that correct? I mean, the way it went was old people realized that their retirement is sort of dependent on funds from England. But young people are more nationalist and more, you know, likely to want to see Scotland as its own country.
Yeah, what people don't appreciate when they're not, you know, citizens of the United Kingdom, is that in the UK, Scottish independence and the idea of more devolution to Wales and more devolution to Northern Ireland, perhaps not Northern Ireland, but definitely Wales and Scotland, these are actually left-wing movements. Whereas you compare that with the United States, And, you know, the movement in Texas to secede is overwhelmingly right wing. You know, these are people who want to keep their guns. These are people who want a small state. These are people who don't want the government telling them what to do. Now, contrast that with Scotland, and actually the independence movement in Scotland is dominated by a left-wing socialist party, the Scottish National Party, which throughout the referendum wasn't giving us arguments on how independent Scotland could truly be, about how the state would be smaller, about how they could become a sovereign country. It was all about how much free stuff the Scottish government would still give to the Scottish people. And of course, the reason that no one actually bought into the argument was because they knew that a country that was even smaller wouldn't be able to afford all of these stuff, because not enough people pay tax in Scotland to fund all of these things. And so I think you can perhaps compare that with the EU. You know, people who want to leave again, more like those Texas secessionists. You know, they want a smaller state, but that's not how things actually. That's not how people think in all of the constituent parts of the United Kingdom.
No, I mean, economics always, in the end, plays a large part in these decisions. I mean, people fear for their, probably for their own private economies, I suppose. And yeah, you know, that probably seems to me was the deciding point in the Scottish referendum. Yeah. And I mean, they've made a really big deal out of it in the whole Brexit debate. How much will Britain lose if they're not a part of the EU? Which is ridiculous to say, because nobody, like we said earlier, nobody knows actually what will happen if there is a Brexit and what the changes will be. So, you know, trying to make economic projections is just silly.
I read in Swedish papers that this Brexit is a real threat to Sweden. Because then we can no longer trade with Britain, and it happens to be one of our biggest trading partners. So we'll have to stop buying everything from Britain and selling to you.
I mean, they make these nonsensical arguments. I mean, there has been trade deals, before the European Union. We could trade with other countries before the European Union. I'm fairly sure I've read it somewhere.
I'm fairly sure we had free trade before the European Union, but. Of course, another big problem with the whole European Union campaign is it has centered on economic arguments. And you can make up any statistics that you like. You can throw lies, damned lies, and statistics. You can say, on the one hand, you know, even the side that wants us to leave has thrown a good deal of lies at the public. That one figure which strikes me as inaccurate from the Leave campaign, one figure is £350 million a week goes to the EU. I'm not entirely sure where that figure comes from, and it's not the full story because the UK does get rebates from the EU. On the other side, however, the lies have been even worse, with David Cameron saying that mortgage rates will definitely go up if we leave the European Union. Well, that really tends to depend on the Bank of England, actually, and base rates and the level of saving and investment in the economy, but we won't go there. They're also saying that the cost of holidays will go up, you know, just to go after the skilled working class, you know, that goes on holiday to Europe. They're saying, oh, you can no longer go to Spain, for a nice holiday for a couple of weeks, but you won't have, national independence, but you also won't have a nice holiday. And so they're throwing all of these statistics out into the air, and you just don't know. You haven't got a clue. One way or the other, how the economy is going to go. The economy depends on lots of things. The economy depends on the economic policies of the government, for one. And the economic policies of the Cameron government have been horrendous. They were elected in order to reduce government spending, and yet they've doubled the national debt in 5 years.
It's almost ridiculous. I mean, I look at numbers from many countries, just, you know, it's a hobby I have. I mean, the British numbers are horrible. I mean, you can't see this going on for very much longer. And, you know, the final thing I was going to ask, I mean, there is inevitably a reckoning day for the British economy. And it would be ironic if this comes, you know, the year after, you know, Brexit, and everyone says, look what happened. And it had nothing to do with Brexit. The economy goes down the toilet, but it was actually due to the reckless spending while you were in the EU.
Well, then they can look at Sweden in parallel, which is still in the EU, and they will have the same, probably even worse.
We will also go down the toilet. So.
But we'll probably, there probably is another economic crash coming. House prices in the United Kingdom are now even higher than they were at the peak of the 2008 bubble, which burst, leading to the Great Recession. Interest rates have been base interest rates set by the Bank of England have been forced down to 0.5%, through quantitative easing and so forth. Asset prices are going up. So we've got another bubble building. Either way, if we're in the EU or if we're not in the EU, we're going to have another economic crash, and that will damage working families. And so, if we stay in, working families are going to be poorer. If we leave, working families are going to be poor. It doesn't make that much difference either way. And what really frustrates me is the assumption nowadays from politicians that all a country is its economy. The only thing that matters is GDP. The UK isn't UK PLC. The UK is meant to be a nation state. And if we leave, we can, in theory, become a nation state again. But again, it will take much more work following that. It will take a revolution within the country, violent or otherwise. It will take a seizing of the government by libertarians to actually shrink the size and scope of the state. This isn't something that the current government wants to do. It isn't something that Boris Johnson will be likely to do. And so the whole Brexit debate, the whole economic debate, all of these things are intertwined and they're all very complicated. But the worst thing you can possibly do is listen to a politician.
I think we can agree there.
Yeah, maybe we should, sort of end on that bright note.
Yes.
We have a little thing we usually do. We ask all our guests to recommend a book, and basically it can be any book. The oddest suggestion so far was Jeff Deist from the American Mises Institute, who chose the Flashman Papers. But related book or unrelated book, do you have anything for our listeners?
That's difficult. I have an idea. The best book, in my view, for actually getting the libertarian message out is probably not an orthodox Austrian school or Rothbardian book, but it worked really well for lots of people that I've recommended it to, is The Market for Liberty by Morris and Linda Tannehill. It's very succinct. It's about 300 pages long or fewer. And it goes through, firstly, the moral argument, and then the economic argument, or might be the other way around. It's a while since I read it, but it's very good, very simple, very well written. And if you want a comprehensive case for a stateless society, I would recommend Morris and Linda Tannehill's The Market for Liberty.
Great.
So just final question here. What do you hope then? Do you hope for a Brexit? And secondly, what do you think? Will there be a Brexit? Formally, at least.
Yeah. Okay. I hope for a Brexit followed by lots and lots of reforms within the United Kingdom, which will shrink the size and scope of the state and limit immigration and actually make use of national sovereignty in a positive way. What I think may happen and what I fear may happen is a Brexit vote followed by a neoconservative Johnson premiership, strengthened ties with neoconservatives all over the world, and particularly the United States, more foreign wars, more puritanical drug restrictions, more immigration, and so on and so forth. If we don't have a real libertarian government, then leaving the EU may not do us that much good.
All right. That was very succinct from Keir Martin. Thank you so much for joining us, Keir. You're, of course, always welcome back anytime
thank you.
You would like. Klaus, any final words?
No, I very much appreciate your joining us today. It was very enlightening.
Well, thank you once again for having me, and I'll be delighted to come back on again.
Yeah. Best of luck with the Libertarian Alliance in the UK.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.